The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. Access 5,000 years of wisdom for less than a dollar. The first month of your Gaia membership is only 99 cents, so sign up today by going to Gaia.com/gym. That's Gaia.com/gym. Thanks, Gaia. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Wink. Wink is offering our audience members who are over 21 and who live in the U.S. a $20 credit plus free shipping on their first order of 4 bottles of wine as a new member of Wink. We thank them for supporting the program. So, for a free bottle of wine with your order, go to trywink.com/gym. That's trywinc.com/gym. Thanks, Wink.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I'm Jim Harold and so glad to be with you once again. And we have two fantastic guests. If you are into cryptids, you are in for a big treat today because we start off with Bobby Hamilton. He's a big part of the new TV series debuting very shortly called Killing Bigfoot. And in part two, we have Seth Breedlove. He's a documentarian, a filmmaker, and he's done movies on such things as the Boggy Creek Monster, the Beast of Whitehall, the Minerva Monster, and up next, yes, Mothman. So I think you'll like this one, and here it is. Our subject today is Killing Bigfoot. It's the new series on Destination America. It's premiering Saturday, February 4th at 10 Eastern, 9 Central. And our guest is a key figure in that program, Bobby Hamilton. He is the founder of the Gulf Coast Bigfoot Research Organization and lead investigator. By day, he's a corporate engineer, but on the side, he has founded the GCBRO to find Bigfoot. And we're going to talk to him about his personal story and why this is so compelling to him. And his mission is to prove to science what he calls aggressive giant ape-like creatures that they exist. Now, the GCBRO is one of the oldest Bigfoot investigative teams in America, going back more than 20 years with Bobby, who is considered one of the best and top Bigfoot researchers in the country. Bobby Hamilton, welcome to the program today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. What got you fascinated to start with Bigfoot? What got this all, the ball rolling, as it were?
Well, a lot of people have already heard my story, but for those that haven't, in 1969 in East Texas, I actually had an encounter with one at our homestead. We had a lot of weird things going on around our house. We never could figure out what was going on. And basically the scene setup is, you know, my mom was there, my two older brothers and my sister, and my dad, he worked offshore on pipeline barges out in the Gulf of Mexico. And so he would be gone for a couple of months at a time, and then he'd be in for a short time and be gone again. So we mostly operated and ran our farm by, you know, just my mom and the kids. So anyway, a lot of weird things was happening. We was hearing a lot of things at night, and you know, it's kind of unnerving to us. You know, we was kids, and my mom, she was there by herself. So she would, a lot of times she would have us sleep in her room, and my sister would sleep with my mom in her bed, and my brother, one of my brothers, would sleep at the foot of the bed on the floor, and I would sleep with my oldest brother under a window right there beside her bed. And it just, one night, I woke up in the middle of the night, and I had to use the bathroom. So I woke my brother up, and I said, hey, could you take me to the bathroom? And with everything that had been going on, I was scared. You know, I was 4 years old, you know, and I didn't want to go to the bathroom by myself. And anyway, he's like, no, go ahead and go to the bathroom. You'll be all right. And I said, no, please, I'm scared. And he, go ahead and go to the bathroom. Well, I kept trying to egg him on to take me, and he finally growled at me. He said, just go to the bathroom. I'll be awake when you get back. I'm like, okay, you know. So walk out the door, the hall light's on, I go down the hall to the restroom and, you know, take care of my business, and I come walking back in the bedroom, and I've got my head down, and right above where our heads was laying, the window's open. You know, it's early fall, it's October, it's cool outside, and I hear a scratch on the screen, and I look up, and there's this apish looking face with, I always called it like a demonic grin, because I could see teeth, and it was motioning for me to come to the window, and I just froze, and I was petrified. I didn't know what to do. I froze, and the next thing I know, I'm being thrown off my brother that was at the end of the bed. I had actually dove on him and was choking him, you know, in a panic, did not know what I was doing, and he jumped up, and he just happened to see this thing turn as it ran from the window. Well, you know, I lived through that, you know, for years, thinking I was the only one that really got a look at it. Well, he got a glimpse of it. Well, years later, I found out, in fact, 14 years later to be exact, my oldest brother, who was I was sleeping with on the pallet under the window, I was visiting him and his wife, and he was at work one day, and I was telling her about this thing I seen in the window. She said, oh, you got to talk to your brother when he comes home. And I'm like, why? He knows I've seen it. She says, no, he's seen it too. I said, no, he didn't see it. You know, our other brother seen it. And she's like, no, he's seen it three times. I'm like, do what? Now you've got me interested. Now I need to talk to him. Well, he was at that age, you know, 14, 15 years old, where he was, you know, trying to be the man of the house while dad was gone. And, you know, at times he would sleep in what we call the boys' room, because me and my two brothers shared a bedroom together. And he was sleeping there by himself to try to, you know, feel big and important. You know, he's at that age. And, you know, he said that on three different occasions, the way the room was set up, you would walk in, we had a set of bunk beds to the right, and had a little double bed to the left, and you could walk around the end of the double bed, and there was a little space to walk around, and to your right, there was a window at the end of the bed. And then, you know, there was a window to the, you know, we turned to the left, there was another window facing you there. So it was two windows in the room. But he said there was three different occasions something startled him awake. He didn't know what it was, but he woke up, but he raised up and looked at the window that was at the end of the foot of the bed. And this thing was standing there motioning for him to come to the window. And he said he would shake his head no. You know, he said he was trying to scream, but he couldn't scream. And this thing was shaking its head yes and motioning for him to come to the window. And he was like, no, you know. He said, Bobby, he said, you know, I thought I was, you know, tough and everything. You know, I was at that age. My testosterone was high. He said, every time this happened, I pulled the covers over my head. And he said, and I'm screaming at the top of my voice, but nothing's coming out for mom or somebody to come in there. And he said, nothing's coming out. He said, I would cry. And he said, I would do that for hours until I finally fell back asleep. He said, I don't know when it would leave. I have no idea. He said, but I was so terrified, I couldn't even scream out loud. And I'm like, wow, okay, that's what I needed, because I knew what I seen. Now I have validation. I have a family member that actually seen it three times, and it did the same thing to him. So that's kind of what got the ball to rolling. And, you know, I went through, you know, my early childhood years, and we moved from that location. We was there for just under a year. You know, it was so bad that this thing had come up into the barn, and it actually killed. I had a pet calf, and this calf was like a dog. I could go out in the field and I could holler Smokey, and this calf would come trotting across there, and I'd pet the calf and everything. It was just a pet.
Right.
This thing had been coming up in the barn. And my mom had told my dad, you know, she had talked to him on the phone, and he told her, he said, take our two German police dogs, which, by the way, was never barking at all when this thing was coming around. He said, take King and Princess, chain them up out there in the barn. He said, whatever's going in there, they'll take care of it. Well, my uncle came over and chained them up in the barn. He chained them to the left side of the barn, and they could get almost to the center of the barn, but their chains wouldn't let them get, you know, to the center of the barn. Well, my mom had went out there one morning and seen it. And she come back in, and she, you know, I woke up. She told me, she said, don't go to the barn. And I'm like, why? Just don't go to the barn. Well, I, you know, messed around a little bit there. And the first chance I got, I go to the barn, you know, cause I want to see why I can't go to the barn. Well, I remember very vividly, just like the thing in the window, my calf is laying in the barn on its left side. It's back towards King and Princess. Now, granted, they cannot get to this point. Their chains will not let them get to where this calf is at. His stomach is ripped open. His insides is pulled into a pile to the right side of him, not back towards king and princes, away from them in a pile. And it's ripped open and it's laying there dead. And, you know, I never put two and two together until I actually got older and got active into the Bigfoot research, you know, what had done that. You know what I mean? Because it was, I could still see it in my mind. You know what I mean? What I seen that day.
Yeah, that's got to be traumatic.
Oh, yes, it was traumatic. It's just like, you know, like I said, the thing I seen in the window. I mean, it traumatized me. And, you know, and as I got older, I'm thinking, you know, well, you know, wild animals, they go in there, they tear these animals open and they pull the insides out. They're not in a pile. You know, they're strung out. But this was all in a nice little pile. And it, like I said, it's facing away from king and princess. You know, if they would have even been able to get to the calf, it would have been maybe towards them, and the insides would have been pulled more towards them, but it wasn't. And, you know, Dad said, "Oh, king and princess, you know, kill the calf." You know, Dad didn't get to experience the things that we was experiencing because it wouldn't happen when he was home.
And that might even, like, imply an intelligence. Don't mess around with him when Dad's home.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, in fact, we have a one of the episodes that we've done. It's a lady that's fairly close to where I live now. She's had quite a few encounters. And her husband, a lot of times he has to work a lot of, you know, weeks and months on nights. And when he's working nights, this thing comes around her house. It's her, and she has a young daughter who's a teenage daughter. She's about 14 or so right now. And then she has another little nephew that stays with them. But when the husband is working nights, this thing comes around her house. And, you know, so it's, I don't know if it's drawn to the, you know, which I always suspect is drawn to the smell of the female hormones, you know, because you got young teenage girls. My sister was a teenager. And then you've got a young girl over here at Miss Anna's place. And this thing's being drawn up there. And it's, you know, just like at our place, it killed my calf. You know, it's attacked her dogs and everything else. And it's kind of the same thing that I went through. And it's beating on the side of their house and everything else. So I can relate to what, you know, she's going through because I lived through it as a child. And it really traumatized me. People that hasn't had any experiences like this, you know, even grown people get traumatized when they have an encounter with these things. But a child...
Sure.
To see something like this, you know, I mean, because you're told there's no such thing as boogeyman. Well, guess what? The boogeyman is out there.
Well, let me ask you this, because this is an important point. I mean, I've always thought, and, you know, I'm not a Bigfoot expert by any means. I mean, I do these shows, but we do them on all kinds of topics, ghosts, UFOs and things. I've probably done, you know, multiple shows on Bigfoot, but by no means am I an expert. I've always thought that Bigfoot was kind of like peaceful. If you didn't bother it, it wouldn't bother you, that kind of thing. Are you saying there's different types of Bigfoot, and the ones in kind of that Gulf Coast area are maybe a lot more aggressive? Am I reading this right?
Well, I can't say for sure that there is different types. You know, I mean, like you said, you're not an expert. I'm not an expert. There is no experts in this field. I mean, the only way there's going to be an expert is for them to have a body to examine and learn everything about it. And then, you know, somebody take that and use it to learn more about them. That's the only way there's ever going to be an expert. But there's people in this field, such as myself, you know, the guys on my team. I mean, we was raised in the country. You know, we used, you know, hunting skills and knowledge and applied it to this. And we've came up with a whole lot more answers than what was available. Cause believe me, I read every book that was available out there. Yeah, I was thirsty for knowledge about this thing. I wanted to know what it was, you know, everything I could find out about it. And I always thought if I could see it one more time, you know, that would just answer my questions. No, because I've seen it again and it raised more questions and it just kept snowballing. Every time I would have an encounter, I had more questions and more questions. And, you know, what I have found out, you know, through what I believe anyway, is before I would say there was different, you know, different types of Bigfoot, I believe there's possible inbreeding going on because we have loss of digits, you know, across the feet and the hands. And, you know, I've seen the five-toed tracks, I've seen four-toed tracks, and I've seen three-toed tracks. And a lot of people, they try to, you know, say, well, did maybe the toes, you know, got frostbitten and fell off? No, that's not the case. You know, they're not grasping the what I'm saying about a three-toed track. the three toes cover up the whole end of the foot, just like five toes would. You know, there's no space in between for another toe to fit. They're big toes. I mean, it's very obvious that this is a legitimate three-toed creature. And, you know, I've seen all the different variances of tracks down here in the South. And I just denote it to possible inbreeding. You know, it could be a different type of Bigfoot, but I'm going with the theory that it's possible inbreeding, because one of the traits of inbreeding is loss of digits and aggressive behavior, you know, because they're really not mentally all there. So anyway, that's what I'm going with, the reason there's differences. And our creatures down south tend to be a lot leaner than the ones, you know, like in the Pacific Northwest, for instance, because, you know, it's like our deer. Our deer are smaller than the deer up there. You know, the habitat is different. The climate is different. We don't have harsh winters down here. You know, they got real harsh winters up north. And so, I mean, if our deer down here, you know, average, you know, a little small deer, you know, 90 to 110, 120 pounds, sometimes they get up 200 pounds. But, you know, you take a 90-pound deer up in the northern states, well, I mean, they'd freeze to death. They don't have the body mass or the, you know, the thick hair or anything else to survive the winters. It's just, I think it's just a different climate and habitat, you know, that they're, the regions that they're in is the difference for that. But the aggressive behavior, you know, I've had encounters where these things have just, they I knew they was there and they left, you know, no problem. But I've had encounters that was very aggressive as well. And it's like I tell everybody that asked me about this, you know, you have good people and bad people out there. Our prison systems are full of bad people, you know, and there's these creatures are no different. You got different temperamentals to these creatures. They're all different temperaments. You know, it's just like a dog out there. You'll have a dog in a yard. This dog is nice. This other dog will eat you alive. You know, there's a different temperament.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And, you know, I believe it's the same way with these creatures. You know, it's, you know, you got different temperaments. You know, you'll have ones that are benign. They're peaceful. They just want to be left alone. They go about their way. But then you have other ones that they're just mean. And that's the ones that we're dealing with and trying to help with, you know, when people's having these encounters. Because, you know, myself, I lived through a bad experience as a child. Michael Humphreys, he's Timber Ghost on the show. He, you know, his family had some bad experiences with him. And, you know, I mean, it's, we all got together, put our knowledge together, our woodsman experience together, and we started coming out with answers that we couldn't find anywhere else. And, you know, I mean, I can't say we're the most successful team out there as far as encounters or anything else, but there's a lot of people claiming to be experts out there that's never even seen one. And I, man, the times and encounters that I've had, I can't count on two hands. I've had a lot of encounters and quite a few sightings since I got started in this, but it's just applying our woodsman knowledge to it. But like I said, there's no experts, but there's some people that seem to have better luck than others at doing this.
Well, we have, I think, one of the closest things you can get to an expert on the line, Bobby Hamilton. He is the founder of the GCBRO and one of the main players on the new television series Killing Bigfoot. Right after this, we're going to ask him, why does Bigfoot need to be killed? And more information on this mysterious creature. Right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. Now, we know that there are a ton of streaming services out there that have great dramatic series, great comedic series, great movies. It's just fantastic. I don't deny that. But there's only one place that you can find the type of information that we're both interested in a streaming service. You want the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained? Well, where do you go? Well, I'll tell you where you go. You go to Gaia. Gaia explores the topics we love and is always providing viewers with tremendous new content that you can stream to your phone, to your Roku device, to your Apple TV, to your computer, to your tablet. You could be Android, you can be iPhone, you can be iPad. It's really platform agnostic, so there's no barrier there. If you love this kind of content, and I know you do because you're listening to the Paranormal Podcast, you have to check out Gaia. Now, every week I've been telling you about new content on Gaia, and this week is no exception. David Wilcock on Wisdom Teachings looks at the world according to Halton Arp. On Buzzsaw, Sean Stone shares the sound of ancient geometry. And there's so much more from favorites like Regina Meredith, George Norrie, Greg Braden, and the list goes on and on and on. And I know that you'll enjoy Gaia. And it's a great time to join because the first month of your membership is only 99 cents, and you can cancel at any time. And let me tell you, think about that. 99 cents. I mean, you can't even buy a coffee with 99 cents. Think about a month of education and entertainment. And again, if you don't like it, you can cancel. They're perfectly willing to kind of put their content on the line and say, hey, we'll give you a great deal just so you can sample it. They're so confident that you'll enjoy it, and I am too. So to mine the wisdom and be entertained and enlightened, just go to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim. To sign up for your first month, it's only 99 cents. Start this new year off right. 5,000 years of wisdom now streaming on Gaia. History like you've never seen it. That's Gaia. Thanks, Gaia. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Bobby Hamilton. He is the lead investigator and founder of the GCBRO. That organization is front and center on the new television series Killing Bigfoot, which premieres Saturday, February 4th at 10 Eastern, 9 Central on Destination America. So, Bobby, I mean, the name itself is controversial. If you look at Killing Bigfoot, I think many people think, well, Killing Bigfoot. Investigating Bigfoot is one thing, but why do we need to kill Bigfoot? Because if the premise is that we need to have one to prove it to science and to find out more about it and see what's behind all this and so forth, why can't we just capture one? Why do we actually have to kill a creature? I think that's probably a big point of controversy out there, and want to get your take on it.
Well, I understand. I mean, there's a lot of people that can't fully grasp our stance on it. But then again, these people haven't had our encounters and haven't had to deal with the things that we've dealt with. So far, all the evidence that's been brought in, and it's been awesome evidence. There's been some very clear, you know, castings, there's, you know, decent photos, audio recordings, hair samples, even blood samples have been brought in. We ourselves brought in a blood sample several years ago from one that did get shot. There was a visitor to our camp that did shoot one in the shoulder, and, you know, we got the blood samples. Everybody was saying at that time, man, all you need is some DNA, it'll prove it. And we was like, well, we don't think so, you know, but, you know, it's better than nothing. And, well, we ended up getting some DNA. It came back as not belonging to any known animal, but it did not prove that it was Bigfoot because they did not have a Bigfoot body on a slab to compare it to say, yes, this is definite Bigfoot blood. So, I mean, we were still, okay, everybody's still up in arms. It's still not proven. So knowing all of this and how people can Photoshop and manipulate pictures and video now as compared to, you know, years back, you know, none of that is going to be proof that this creature exists. The only thing that's going to prove it is for scientists to have a body on a slab so they can examine this body. And that's it. And, you know, everybody's like, well, it's a peaceful creature. Why do you want to kill it? Yes, some of these creatures are shy and elusive, and they want to be left alone. But we're not dealing with those creatures. We're dealing with the creatures that are actually terrorizing families and their homes. And everybody's out there, well, so it kills your chicken. So it kills your dog. So what? Well, if a wolf comes into your yard and is eating up your dog, killing your chickens, you know, are you going to sit there and let it keep doing that? Or are you going to be fearful that it might get one of your children? I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to take care of the situation. And that's the way, you know, we're dealing with this thing right here. The ones we're dealing with is not these benign, peaceful creatures. They're aggressive. They're coming in too close to the homes and terrorizing families. And nobody who's ever sat in a high rise apartment in New York City, you know, and never had an encounter or dealings like this, they have no voice, as far as I'm concerned, to say anything about what we're doing because they don't have the experience of having to deal with this, you know, the trauma that it causes your family. I mean, you know, now, I mean, people are getting all bent out of shape over a presidential election and having to have counseling and everything else. That's not traumatic. Traumatic is having a real live monster coming around your house, killing your animals, your pets, your livestock, looking in your windows, banging on your house, and terrifying you to where, you know, you're scared for dark to come because you don't know what's going to happen after it gets dark. You know, and that's the creatures that we're going after. And, you know, there's a bigger picture that people just don't grasp about this. Once we got one on a slab, science can study it. We can find out ways to deter it, to try to keep it from coming up around people's houses, as well as, you know, they can set aside, you know, protection services to protect the creatures because they're not protected now. You know, and everybody said, well, there's a law, you can't kill them. Well, okay, whatever. You know, I mean, guess what? Texas said it's not illegal to kill one because they don't exist. So how could you have a law to protect something that doesn't exist? Okay, the bottom line is, in the southern states, which, you know, it's pretty much that way in a lot of the heavily wooded, you know, states of the United States, there's a lot of deforestation going on. There's a lot of clear-cutting going on. The habitats are being depleted, you know, and by no means am I somebody that runs out there and hugs a tree and I'm riding and, you know, having demonstrations to protect the trees by any means. However, you know, when I was a kid, I was able to go hunt squirrels and deer in hardwood bottoms, river bottoms and creek bottoms, plenty of hardwoods. Well, the hardwoods are being depleted as well. Everything's been replanted with pine trees, and there's nothing in the forest that can live solely off a pine tree. They need the hardwoods, the fruits and nuts that comes off the hardwoods to survive, and all of it's being depleted. So there's a bigger picture here. In bringing a body in to prove it to science, they can set up all types of protection to protect the creature. They can set aside habitat for the creatures to thrive, as well as, you know, figure out ways to deter it from coming around, you know, people's homes and everything else and terrorizing them. So, you know, these people don't think it through. They're just thinking at the moment right here, you know, like, oh, you're going to kill this creature. Well, there's never been a creature that's been identified by science that hasn't been killed and brought in to be studied. You know, they didn't bring one in a cage. If it was brought in a cage, science killed it so they could dissect it and study it.
Interesting perspective on that. Now, let me ask you this. Are there any reports of these creatures having in any way harmed a human? Is there anything like that that's been documented?
Well, it's funny you ask that because one of our episodes that's coming up, we do have a report that we went on, did our investigation, where a young man was walking down the road at night, and he heard something off to the side of him, and this thing actually football tackling on this dark two-lane country road one night. It tackled him in the road, and he scuffled around with it for a little bit there before he could get away with it. And, I mean, there's been other things that I've heard about, but, you know, that's one that's in my mind fresh because that's an investigation that our team's been working on, and it's also going to be in one of the upcoming shows. So it's very interesting. But, yes, they have attacked people.
Now, I don't want you to give anything away, but can you give us just a brief taste of what we're going to expect when we tune into Killing Bigfoot on February 4th?
Well, you're going to have Miss Anna's place. We have my daughter does help us on some of our investigations. You know, she's a full-time college student, so when she's available, you know, she goes out with me and investigates. And in fact, all my kids get involved, but they're not all on the show. It's just my oldest daughter. But she goes with us. In this one particular case, we was at Miss Anna's place and was having our hunt at night, and there was an old wooden stand that we was using, Brandy and myself was using, and it wasn't the type of stand I would normally hunt out of, but it was there, so we used it, and it had some blind spots on it. This thing came up from the blind spot, and it shook the stand pretty good while we was in there, and I thought the stand was going to fall. I mean, it was shaking it that hard, and the stand wasn't very stable. I was sure the stand was going to fall, and, you know, we was going to be hurt. Soon as it quit, I jumped to the opening where I could look out, and it was gone. And, you know, it really infuriated me because me is one thing, but my daughter was in there, and that infuriated me. And I've actually been back there several times since, you know, at Miss Anna's place. I've been over there doing everything I can to get a shot at this thing because I kind of got a vengeance against it now. It kind of got personal. But we got another incident that that'll be coming up. We've got a young man who's got a back issue, and he's in a wheelchair. He's been in a wheelchair, you know, his whole life, and he's married, and they got a nice little home out in the country out there. Well, he had an encounter, and it, you know, it got us in touch with him. We went over there, and right there in the woods, right by his house, we cast a big, huge handprint. And, you know, when we show it to him, you can see the terror in his face. You know, it's like, look, this is what we found. We found it right over here. And the look on his face, you know, and he comes, the first thing out of his mouth was, my God, that's a monster. Because the hand is that big. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a lot of good stuff coming up. I mean, it's, you know, it's exciting. You know, we've had a lot of exciting things happen. So I believe people will be interested and they need to look at it from different views. Look at it from the witness's view, the people that are being, you know, terrorized and traumatized by this thing. It, when people look at the world, they tend to look at it through just their view. And it's the way it should be, is their view. Well, there's, the world doesn't work like that. There's different views. We can agree to disagree, you know, on everything. We can agree to disagree, but it's, there's more than one view of things. And so they need to step outside their little box and look at it from different views. I mean, they're viewing as it's a peaceful creature. We don't need to harm it. We need to bring it in the house like Harry Henderson, feed it popcorn and watch it. Yeah. And watch a Jerry Springer show and laugh and have a good time. But this isn't how this works. They're so out of touch with reality that this is a wild animal. It's not a peaceful creature. It's a wild animal. Even one of the peaceful creatures, if you get too close to it and hem it up, or you get close to one of its young, it's going to do exactly what any mother would do, whether she's, you know, a human or a wild creature. She's going to protect her young, and it's going to get bad. So people don't, they're not grasping this.
Well, the show is Killing Bigfoot, and it's going to start on Saturday, February 4th at 10 Eastern, 9 Central on Destination America. And we've been talking with Bobby Hamilton. He is the founder of the GCBRO and lead investigator. Bobby, do you have any last words for our audience before we sign off?
All I want to say is y'all need to watch our show. I mean, y'all need to see how this is really done, how real Bigfoot researchers actually conduct themselves in the field, and we give pretty good tips on how we conduct our hunts. And it's a very exciting show. And, you know, you've seen the rest. Now come look at the best. That's us, the GCBRO.
Well, there you have it. Bobby, thank you for joining us today and all the luck in the world with the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, I enjoyed that interview with Bobby, and we thank him for coming on the program and giving his perspective, because on the face of it, you know, that might sound very controversial why you would want to kill Bigfoot, but at least now we have Bobby and his team's perspective and we can make our own judgments. Next up, we're going to have Seth Breedlove. He is the chief cook and bottle washer of Small Town Monsters. They are movie makers, documentarians, and he's turning his lens on Mothman. And we'll talk to him right after this most important message. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Wink. Wink is offering our audience members who are over 21 and who live in the U.S. a $20 credit plus free shipping on their first order of 4 bottles of wine as a new member of Wink. Now, I've told you before, I love Wink. You know, I've always been kind of a beer guy, and many times I think it was because I was intimidated by wine. And I've told you the stories where I go to parties as a young man, just into the workforce with kind of these very nice, but a little bit snooty people. And they just go around, oh, this is a lovely rosé. I just love it. And it turned me off. So I'm like, wine's not for me. I come from a working class background. It's not my thing. But Wink has changed this. Now, what is Wink? Wink is a wine club. And it's targeting a new generation of wine drinkers who want to do away with all that pretense I told you about and enjoy reasonably priced, great wine. And the nice thing is you go over there and you take their 20-second palate profile quiz, don't have to know anything about wine, and then they suggest, hey, this is one that you might like. Now, Wink custom tailors wines to the tastes of the individual consumer and ships 3 bottles of wine each month to your doorstep for only $39 plus a flat $6 shipping rate. And the price point for most wines is $13. And if you've shopped for wine, you know that's a great price. So by signing up for Wink with the offer I'm going to tell about, you're going to get your first bottle for free. Now, here it is. Wink is offering our audience members who are over 21 and who live in the U.S. a $20 credit plus free shipping on your first order of 4 bottles of wine as a new member of Wink. I absolutely love Wink. And recently we've been enjoying some of their Pacificana Zinfandel. And the thing that I love about Wink is you can actually go in as you're selecting the wines, or maybe once you have the wines, they come with these great, well, you can go online and research them anytime, and they have all these cool videos. And then when you get it, you get this nice little card that tells you about the wine. So not only are you enjoying fine wine, reasonably priced, tailored to the things that you enjoy eating and drinking, but you can also educate yourself. These little cards have a little synopsis of everything about the wine. It is so cool. I think you're going to love it. It's a great thing, you know, as you entertain. It's always nice to have some wine. If this is wine, you just don't go out and get in the supermarket. So it's something a little bit unique. And I hate to say, maybe you'll be able to show off a little bit. But don't be pretentious, because that's not what it's about. But I do tell you to try Wink. And under that category, go to trywink.com/Jim. That's trywinc.com/Jim to receive that $20 credit and free shipping on 4 bottles of wine on your first order. Again, go to trywink.com/Jim. I enjoy it. It's added something to my parties that I have. And in fact, we're going to probably have a wine party here soon. I think that's going to be a lot of fun. I'll get to show my new knowledge. But I I'm not going to talk about how the wine has nice legs. But check it out at trywink.com/Jim. Thanks, Wink. And please drink responsibly. Our guest today is Seth Breedlove. Now, if he's a familiar name, he should be. He's been on the shows before. He's the chief cook and bottle washer over at Small Town Monsters. And what they do are make great films about the supernatural. They have Minerva Monster, Beast of Whitehall, and Boggy Creek Monster. But guess what? There's something else coming, and that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about the new project on Mothman, and we're so glad to have Seth with us. Welcome, Seth.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for having me back on.
Why Mothman?
I actually think Mothman is why I'm into any kind of a paranormal cryptid subject to begin with, because back in 2002, the Mothman Prophecies movie came out, and that movie's kind of gotten a bad rap since then, particularly like in the cryptid and paranormal communities. But when that movie came out, I went to see it 6 or 7 times with a certain group of my friends constantly. We just kept going back to the Dollar Theater to see it. I was so fascinated with it. And I can remember my sister, who wasn't even into like paranormal subjects at all, she bought John Keel's book. And I remember flipping through that book, and I honestly think that book plays a strong role in why I'm into these subjects to begin with. But I've always loved the Mothman story, not just because it's this cool kind of monster story, but because there's so much more going on in that, you know, particular case. It's not just a creature sighting, it's also UFOs and Men in Black stuff, and a lot more, as we've come to find since I started working on it myself.
Well, I love that movie. I'm kind of, I guess I'm in the minority in the paranormal community. I love that movie, fully realizing that a lot of it was fictionalized or drummed up. Plus, you've got Richard Gere playing John Keel. And if anybody's seen a picture of John Keel, he did not look like Richard Gere, but that's okay. I still thought it was a very, very cool and very entertaining movie. And the thing about that, the thing that I love about fiction or based on a true story kind of stuff is that it gives you an opening, an avenue to think about other thoughts. For example, recently I've been watching The Man in the High Castle on Amazon, and not to spoil it, but it does get into the idea of alternative universes and so forth. And it's a great launching point then to go read the actual real stuff on it. So I think it's a great entry point. Now, let's talk a little bit about the Mothman case. Maybe we can kind of recap it. And folks, in a little bit, we're going to tell you on how you can help make this movie happen, because Seth is, like me, independent, entrepreneurial, but not making a gabillion doing this. So this really is a labor of love for him. And we're going to tell you how you can help make this movie. But first, kind of recap, maybe for those who kind of in passing are familiar with Mothman, but maybe it's not top of mind, they don't know the details. Kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of what happened in 66, 67 with Mothman in that Point Pleasant, West Virginia area.
Right. Well, the story that kind of kicked off the whole thing was there were two couples that were out in this a wildlife management area today, but back then was just an abandoned TNT factory and a kind of a weird, very unusual setting, actually. It was used as a TNT storage and management facility during World War II, and then was subsequently abandoned, and kind of the whole place eventually turned into basically a chemical dump for major companies like Goodyear to come and just dump their toxic chemicals into these bunkers. The bunkers were built to kind of contain blasts and to store the ingredients for TNT. So basically, over time, this area had become this very overrun place where kids would kind of hang out. And these two couples were out there one night, and they claimed to see this man-like bird creature, this tall, 7 foot tall creature with a 10 foot wingspan, standing by the side of the road. And they claimed that they had seen it and taken off, you know, to get out of there. And it had ended up chasing them into town, and they went to the police, and the story kind of became your classic kind of small town monsters case, in that they went to the police, the story hit the media. Before you know it, there's mobs of people out at the TNT area looking for the Mothman. And that's for most people, that's the story. That's the story of Mothman, and that's what they know about Mothman. But obviously there's been a lot of documentaries that have covered this, and books and all kind of stuff. What I've never seen is a kind of in-depth look at the timeline, the chronology of the Mothman. And the reason I say that is because there is history that this had gone on for a lot longer than just 1966, when the Scarberries and the Mallets had their sighting out at TNT. This had been in the local kind of folklore even before 1966, and even into the early part of the 20th century. So I wanted to make a movie that would show all of that, you know, the prehistory of the Mothman, bringing you all the way up till today and what's going on with it. Obviously, after the Mallets and the Scarberries had their sighting, other people had their sightings, most memorably people like Marcella Bennett, who was out at the TNT factory area one night with some friends. And she was also with her baby. She had her baby Tina with her, and she claimed that a creature swooped down. She dropped the baby and fell on it. And that's kind of, there's all these little side stories to the Mothman legend that have become kind of epic in their own ways. You know, there's all these really famous side stories, but what I had never seen done and what we want to do is kind of lay out, this is what happened. It started here. It continued to here, naturally led to this, and show that it was a lot more than just the Mothman sightings, that there were also a lot of strange activities going on around Point Pleasant at that time, and kind of culminating with that collapse of the Silver Bridge in 1967.
Now, it's interesting. I'm just going to say this as a sidebar, and I've mentioned on some of the shows before, my family was from West Virginia, but a different part of West Virginia. But in probably around 1970, in a different part of West Virginia, my parents had a very weird experience that has some commonalities with some of the Mothman sightings, some slight commonalities. I'll just tell it real quickly. And that, I think that's even more why this interests me more. And I will say this. I'm a little bit older than you, Seth. I'm in my 40s, mid-40s, and I heard this story in the 70s before I ever knew of Mothman or John Keel or any of that. But anyway, the story was this. My mom and dad dropped me off at grandma's because we were visiting. I've always lived up in Ohio. I was born and raised here, but we were back visiting. I was a baby. They dropped me off to stay with grandma for a bit, and they went to this secluded area that was down a dirt road and so forth. And they parked. Now, I don't want to know why, but anyway, but anyhow, they parked. And all of a sudden, my dad saw a flash of light that was bright enough to light up the speedometer in his 1968 Buick LeSabre. And again, we're talking about, you know how those rural areas are. This is pitch black. There's no lighting. Lit it up where you could literally read the numbers from the speedometer. Then he said he saw a man to his left outside the driver's side window with what he called a welding mask, and who lifted his hand up. At that point, he decided, I'm getting out of here. And then he was flying out down these dirt roads and things. And then my mom said, now she's passed. She said, then we saw the birds on the bank of the hill with the biggest wings I ever saw in my life. Now, anyway, So that's kind of weird. I've also talked to some people on the shows who do work into screen memories and owls and things, maybe speculating those were owls. My mom saw everything except she didn't see the man with the, quote, welding mask. So when I found out about the Mothman sightings, even though there's a few years separated and, you know, it's on the other side of the state up by the Maryland border, I just thought that was kind of wild that it wasn't quite a Mothman experience, but it was certainly something strange that had a few commonalities.
Boy, I mean, it fits in. It definitely does have a lot of commonalities, because when you look at the Mothman stories, you know, I brushed over the Scarberries and the Mallet sighting is kind of a straightforward case. You know, they saw this creature, it chased them into town. Now, it gets weird as far as what Linda encountered later in life. She claimed that after that occasion, she saw the Mothman frequently, kind of until the day she died even, and that she also had poltergeist activity and all that kind of stuff too. But there are a lot of, like, strange lights in the sky, and the case that always comes up, that people always talk about, is the Woodrow Derenberger case, the Woody Derenberger case that took place. Now, as iconic as the Woody Derenberger case is, and as tied into Mothman as it typically is, it didn't take place in Point Pleasant and really wasn't even that close to Point Pleasant. So given that fact and the fact that it's already been covered, you know, very in depth in other movies, I think we'll probably skim over that case. But that's kind of what I'm thinking of when you're saying what you're saying, just because it's your dad recounting seeing the guy in the welding mask and the light in the sky. It really does. And then the birds is what stands out to me.
Yeah.
That stands out to me because of the fact that there were people that saw large birds in Ohio in Hocking County around that same time that these cases were going on in 66. There was a family living in Hocking County, Ohio, that claimed they saw four very large birds in the trees near their house and watched them, I think, for up to 2 hours. So, and that's what we're finding out, is that this wasn't, even descriptions of the Mothman seemed to differ from person to person. There were, I think, four or five pilots at the Gallup Police Airport in 66 who claimed to see a large bird with a 4-foot neck and a beak that looked like a pterodactyl fly over the airport. They thought it was a plane. That's how big it was. When they first saw it coming, they thought it was an airplane. And this is right around the same time as the Mothman sightings. But if you listen to their description, it's nothing like what the witnesses of the Mothman were claiming to see. They weren't seeing a beak. They weren't seeing, you know, a neck. In fact, the thing they saw didn't seem to have a neck at all. Its head, you know, it is very, the Scarberry Mallet description of the creature in a lot of ways does kind of sound like a misidentified owl, except that there's the fact that they also say it was man-like. So what people were describing when they were seeing the Mothman, not that there's no commonality, but people were describing seeing a lot of different unusual flying creatures down in that area around this time.
Yeah, it really isn't. And I think that's one of the things that has me fascinated about this case. And again, my family has two paranormal stories. That's it. And that's one of them, or ones that could be paranormal. And the thing is that these were not people who were steeped in this kind of thing. They weren't reading Brad Steiger books, or they didn't have pyramids under their bed just trying to figure out their chakras or anything like that. I mean, they were pretty salt of the earth people. So it's always stuck with me since I heard that since I was a little child. Now, Mothman himself, I mean, what kind of powers do people say that he has in terms of flight, and what does he look like? I know you talked about different descriptions. What are some of the commonalities that you hear?
The Scarberries claimed it was able to chase their car and stay with them, even though they were traveling speeds up to 95 miles per hour. That's been exaggerated. 95 miles per hour is what they originally said. And if you know the roads out there at the TNT area, there is a flat stretch of straight road where it would make sense that they would be going that fast, although it's still dangerous out there regardless. Those roads are nasty. But this thing supposedly kept up with their car flying that quickly. Now, the thing that stands out the most in these reports, and that kind of draws similarities to some of our Bigfoot movies, is the fact that this thing had these red glowing eyes, and many, many people recounted the red glowing eyes. In fact, almost anyone that saw this thing in the dark, you know, recounted the eyes as being unlike anything they'd ever seen. I think in our interview that's going to be in our film with Faye DeWitt, she talked about the eyes as being unlike anything she'd ever seen. And you always hear that coals, like coals of fire. People with the Boggy Creek Monster, that was something you heard often, actually, is that the creature had eyes like coals of fire. I think that's what Mary Beth Searcy, or one of the Searcys, had said about the creature. But that's the physical trait that most typically does come across in every, you know, report, is these eyes. I spoke with a person that was actually with Marcella Bennett. Now, unfortunately, I have not been able to convince this person to talk to me on camera, but they were actually with Marcella Bennett that night. And when she talked about the eyes, she said, well, let me run back to that Marcella Bennett story real quick so I can explain. So after Marcella saw the creature and dropped the baby, she scooped the baby up and they went into the house. And once they were in the house, they saw the eyes of the creature looking into the house. So it came to the house and was actually looking in at them. Now, what I did leave out there is that what they originally saw in the sky were lights in the sky, like a UFO in the sky. And then they looked off to the side and they saw the Mothman actually standing underneath these lights. So when they were seeing the lights, the eyes looking into the house after they had gone inside the house, what this person that was there that night told me is that they were actually very small eyes. They didn't, you typically think of the Mothman eyes as these kind of bulbous glowing eyes, but she said they were very small, but she said they were piercingly red, which made her think that they weren't from an owl or something like that. So I did think that was interesting, because typically you think of the Mothman, even looking at the Mothman statue, it's these massive kind of bulbous eyes, but this lady described them almost as naturally, you know, nothing abnormally huge, but the way they were red is what stood out to her. And she's kind of, this person's actually a Mothman skeptic, despite being there that night. But I thought that was interesting to hear that description from someone that was there. So yeah, that typically the wingspan is massive. I think typically it goes anywhere from 5 to 10 feet. The weird thing about 10 feet is the typical height of Mothman is, you know, 6 to 7 foot in that area. And if you think about a creature that's 6 to 7 foot with a wingspan that's 10 feet, it doesn't make a ton of sense, you know, how the creature would actually fly biologically, how a natural creature would fly with a wingspan that's only 10 feet long, you know, 10 feet wide when it's 7 feet tall. What's also really unusual about the creature, and it's something Keel talked about occasionally, is that when it would fly, it wasn't like it was flapping its wings. It would take off into the sky. You know, and then the other thing is that occasionally when people saw it, they almost heard kind of an engine noise, like a motor running. And I think at one point in a lecture or something, he hypothesized that maybe it was something similar to like a hummingbird. You know, like maybe they were hearing you know how a hummingbird, when it's close to you, you kind of hear that the wings flap. Well, it could have been something like that. But the way this thing moved and flew did not seem to be very, you know, natural. And you didn't see the wings kind of flapping, you know, when it took off into the sky like you would a bird.
So the different theories on Mothman, whether it's, you know, I think some people have said it's a crane, or as you said, a bird, or those kind of things. I mean, what are I mean, we've got those natural explanations, which still wouldn't account for some of the more supernatural theories. What are some of the more out there theories? Are we talking aliens? Are we talking something coming from another dimension? What are some of the other theories that might be a little more on the paranormal side?
Keel got into this idea of ultra-terrestrials, and he was into alternate dimensions and that kind of thing. And that was, I think, at the end of his days. Of course, Keel had said that anytime you're looking into something like this, you're basically looking into demonology. Now, personally, what I'm seeing are a lot of different explanations across various sightings. I do think some people saw an owl. There's a famous sighting that's often tied into the Mothman case by two men, Benjamin Enochs and Paul Yoder. And I actually spoke to one of them on the phone recently, and he didn't want to be involved in a Mothman story, so he won't be in the film. But he told me what they saw was a large owl. So despite the fact that they were often connected to the Mothman sightings, he very clearly, and if you even go back and read his initial description of what he saw in the newspaper, he's saying even back then it was an owl. So there was actually a large owl that was killed in the area at that time. abnormally large, you know, with a wingspan. I think the wingspan was 5 feet, something like that. So it was a pretty big owl. But that does not account for the descriptions of the pilots at the airport who saw the creature that sounds more like a pterodactyl or something. Now, you could chalk that up to a sandhill crane. You know, there's Joe Nichols is often famously talking about how he believes this was a sandhill crane. I personally don't believe you can explain away every single sighting as being a sandhill crane. Some of the more outlandish descriptions, not outlandish, you know, by my terms, but this is the more paranormal kind of side of things. A lot of people believe it could have been some sort of alien creature that was dropped off as a scout. I've heard that one. And like I said, another dimension, a creature from another dimension. There were often a sizzling sound kind of associated with this thing appearing, almost like a pop and a sizzle. And then it would appear. So people, you know, and interestingly enough, in the Mothman Prophecies, Keel talks about how at one point he had gone back to the TNT plant and he was there with a few of the original witnesses. And I think Connie Carpenter was there that night, and some of those people. And he recounted here having an experience where his ears popped, and he connected that with the a change in pressure in the atmosphere, which I think he described as possibly being connected like a portal or something opening up. So there's all that. There's the typical UFO. There's, you know, people like my friend Zach, who's shooting the movie, believes maybe it was some sort of, you know, like government experiment gone wrong, you know, like some sort of. You got to remember the TNT area, even today, is still a bit of a disaster. It was listed as one of the EPA's 10 worst disasters in the United States, the most needed for like chemical cleanup because of the amount of chemicals that seeped into the water and stuff there. So if animal mutation was a possibility, it would make sense that an animal, a bird or something, could have mutated in that particular region, the TNT area. Personally, I spoke with a couple people here in Ohio, actually at the Stark Parks Department, who said that they don't know of any case where an animal, an owl or a bird, has mutated to such a degree. But they said certainly anything would be possible with that many, you know, with that amount of chemical leakage going on and the amount of stuff that was going on in the TNT area. But I'll tell you this, Jim, out of everything I've looked into, this is the one that when people ask me, do you believe in the Mothman? I'm probably going to say no, because the Mothman description, the Mothman moniker is kind of it's not entirely factual. It was made up by a guy, you know, it was granted by a guy at a newspaper who was just trying to come up with a name for the creature. Now, there are so many different sightings of this thing and so many different sightings of different things that people eventually chalked up as the Mothman. I don't know what to make of it.
It's like a catch-all. Yeah. You see something weird, it's the Mothman. Now, let me ask you this. Now, this is the part that was, you know, you take weird and then you get into weirder. Can you talk a little bit about what happened in December of 1967, the Silver Bridge? And here's where it gets strange. The connection between Mothman, the supposed connection between Mothman and the Silver Bridge.
So this is one part that I'm very conscious of how we portray it in the movie. The Silver Bridge collapse is what drew me to this story, and not because I connected it to Mothman at all. I was drawn to this story because I spoke to a police officer while I was at the Mothman Festival who was in grade school at the time of the bridge collapse. And he recounted losing a good friend. Actually, she was only in sixth grade. Her name was Linda. She died on the bridge. And in fact, I think someone told me she's one of the only, there's two people that whose bodies they never found. And she was one of them, if I'm not mistaken. And he recounted actually going and his schoolmates and him planting a tree in her memory. And when he told me that story, it affected me emotionally. It affected him emotionally. He was almost crying when he was telling it to me. And it's been, how, you know, 50 years since that happened. He was just a kid at the time. But the fact that it still affects the town so much is kind of what drew me to the story. And what I've learned in my looking into this is that there more than likely is no connection at all to the Mothman sightings. Now, there's one, I believe it was a truck driver who claimed to have seen the Mothman actually fly over the bridge shortly before the collapse. But I'm not sure you know, you're talking about one witness set of however many people were there that day that recounted something like that.
Yeah. And did he report it before or after the collapse?
After the collapse. Well, after the collapse, actually decades after the collapse. So yeah, that makes me question it as well. But, you know, it's just such a fascinating piece of the puzzle. And it's, you know, the 13th I-bar on the bridge is the I-bar that gave out, that caused the collapse, which is unusual because the number 13 pops up in this case a lot. You know, it's 13 months from the time of the Scarberry sighting to the day to when the bridge collapsed. So the Scarberry sighting that kind of kicks off the uproar over the Mothman situation leads to eventually 13 months later, the collapse of the Silver Bridge, after which point the Mothman sightings kind of fade away. Now, people claim to still see the creature even to today, but if you look at, you know, when the media stopped covering it, when people stopped talking about it, it's right around 13 months. It's 13 months to the day from the time the Scarberry sighting to the bridge collapse. Now, there were sightings that took place before the Scarberry sighting, and something that I found out thanks to Lauren Coleman and his Mothman book is that there were, and actually originally written by Mark Hall in his book on Thunderbirds, there were sightings of a large bird in the Point Pleasant area preceding tragedies all the way back to World War I.
Right. See, that was the question I was going to have, is the thought that the Mothman was some kind of harbinger of doom, maybe in some kind of strange otherworldly way, trying to warn everybody of something bad going to happen.
That's what you got to wonder. And that's something, it's a very romantic notion. That's what I'll say. I love the idea of this creature that's trying to warn, you know, angel or demon or whatever it was. I love the idea. Personally, I don't know what I think of that. I know that our composer, our film composer for the movie, Brandon Dalo, he's kind of basing the score around that idea. When he's thinking of the score in a lot of these songs, he's trying to put himself in the headspace of this creature that's trying to communicate something, because that's something you hear very often. It was a creature that was trying to communicate, you know, but didn't know how to do it.
Now, philosophically, when you do your films about these different creatures, do you look at, is it kind of based on a true story, a little bit of fictionalization, or do you solely look at it as just the facts? We're going to get the facts out and, you know, we're going to make it as interesting and as engaging as we can. How do you approach that?
Yeah, the most frustrating, and I'm 100% sure you've dealt with this too, the most frustrating thing about this is really at the end of the day, we have no idea who's telling us the truth and who's lying when we're taking these stories.
Sure.
So what we, you know, if anything gets completely to the point where it's, you know, someone's running off into a spaceship and leaving and coming back with 30 Mothman children and stuff like that, you know, like I'd probably draw the line at that. But when it comes to who we're talking to, I definitely am usually trying to be extremely cautious about who we're putting in the movie. With a story like this, one of the things that seems to be coming together for us is that we've managed to get so many of the original accounts into our movie, which is really exciting, because coming into this, the story is so old and a lot of these people have passed away. In fact, Faye DeWitt is really the only, there are people tangentially still connected to the Mothman case, but Faye is kind of the only one who is constantly brought up, who's still around. But we've, much like we did with Beast of Whitehall, we found audio and video interviews that haven't been out there that we're going to be able to include in our film to kind of give these people a voice and to help tell the history of this sighting. So, no, I mean, for me, we don't do over-dramatized reenactments, and the storytelling on this movie is very somber, you know, which for us, it all comes from that original idea I had of let's do something that will also talk about the Silver Bridge and the tragedy of the Silver Bridge. So when you're coming at a story, even if it's as about something that to some people would be as outlandish as the Mothman, you've got to tell it with a certain amount of respect because of the fact that it does have the 46 lives that were lost connected to it. So when we took our first trip down to Point Pleasant, my cinematographer and I, we had a long talk about what is the feel of this movie? Because Boggy Creek Monster is a very kind of fun, adventurous film. It really, like, a lot of very consciously while we were making it, we did a ton of camera movement. You know, let's move the camera a lot. Let's always be moving forward. And in this movie, our talks were more like, all right, everything's on sticks. Every camera's locked down. Not that it won't be a fun movie, because I really think you can't tell a story like the Mallets and the Scarberry sighting initially without it being kind of interesting and scary and fun and creepy and all that kind of stuff. But it will be, I think, a somber kind of tone, especially toward the end of the film when we do get to the Silver Bridge collapse. And you'll see some of the locals, how it still affects them to this day. I mean, it's and obviously it would. You're talking about a tragedy that took 46 lives in a town with just a few thousand people. Everyone's going to know someone that died on that bridge. So yeah, that's our thing is always coming at these in the most realistic, ground level, factual way as possible, and basically kind of create the opposite of what you see on most documentaries about these subjects.
Now, you're an independent. You're like me. No big corporations or anything else backing you. You do it yourself. And that's I love what you do, because I kind of see a mirror image in the sense I do it with podcasting. You do it with films. I think it's the way to go for creative folks these days. If you want to have control and kind of make your vision happen. But to make that vision happen, since we're independents, we need the help of our audiences. So the question is, if somebody's listening now and they want to see this movie, how do they help make it happen?
Yeah, and we've done, this will be our third, but we've done three when this one launches. We've done three of these crowdfunding campaigns. And the first one was to fund the post-production side of Minerva Monster. And the last one was to fund pretty much all the production on Boggy Creek Monster. This one is actually to fund post-production on the Mothman of Point Pleasant and all of our production for our fifth movie, which should actually be out Halloween of this year. We're putting out two movies this year. So that movie's called Invasion on Chestnut Ridge, which will delve a little bit into like UFOs and really bizarre activity that's gone on in the Chestnut Ridge kind of area. So yeah, on February 2nd, we're launching the Kickstarter for this. And the coolest thing about this one is we partnered up with I have a friend named Gene St. Jean, who's a sculptor and designer. Honestly, you've probably seen some of his statues and figures. He's done work for like Marvel and DC, and he's done Universal Monster action figures and all kinds of stuff. But he works with a guy named Jeff Byers, and they run a company called Creature Replica, which does cryptid action figures. And we've been talking about doing something together for a long time. So they wanted to create a Mothman statue for a statue line they're starting up. And they're going to do basically a variant exclusive paint job, kind of a bronze finish for us. And that's going to be one of the Kickstarter rewards. So it's actually a Mothman statue that we're going to be able to include as a reward in this campaign. And then we'll have we always do t-shirts. We're going to have a Sam Sheeran t-shirt of the Mothman and a Small Town Monsters t-shirt. And we've got a really cool exclusive poster coming from Matt Harris, who does a lot of our illustrations and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, February 2nd, the Kickstarter launches, and we're excited because we've never tackled two productions in a year. Now, during 2016, we put out Beast of Whitehall and we made and released Boggy Creek Monster, but this time we're actually producing. So we're actually all the production of both of these movies is taking place in 2017. We did a little bit of filming at the end of 2016 on Mothman, but the bulk of our filming is taking place. It's still going on. Our last weekend of filming is going to be February 11th. So we're going to finish up filming, go right into editing. And I can tell you the Mothman movie is going to be, you know, I said it's locked down and very somber, but it's going to be a very stylized kind of film too. We're going to have our first ever animated sequence in the movie. A buddy of mine's going to be kind of animating one of the encounters in the story. And we've just got a whole bunch of things kind of cooked up that are going to, you know, because when you're dealing with the Mothman, you're dealing with something that's been in pop culture for decades and that's had multitudes of documentaries made about it. And that's the thing. People kept asking me, even going into producing this, why are you doing another Mothman documentary? And I said, well, the big thing is we tell personal stories. That's what we do. It's a personal take on these massive legends. And I've never seen that with this story. And I've also never seen anything that very clearly laid out the timeline of how these events happened and how everything happened and how unusual it was for this town to have this whirlwind of craziness going on around it. So that's kind of what we're doing with this whole thing. And I think it's a story worth telling again, even though it has been told before. I think it's a story worth telling again in a way that I haven't seen done.
Very, very cool. So the question is, if people want to check out the Kickstarter, also check out your other movies, how can they go about such things?
The Kickstarter launches February 2nd. So if you're listening to this now and you don't want to use our Facebook or whatever, you can just go to Kickstarter and search Mothman. I think it's actually going to be listed under the Mothman of Point Pleasant. So you'll be able to just search Mothman and it should pop up. Small Town Monster should also bring it up. But Facebook, we're on facebook.com/SMLTownMonsters. And we're on Amazon. Everything, the previous three movies we've done, they're all on Amazon and Vimeo On Demand. And then we're on all social media as well, like you are, Jim. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and all that stuff. So we're out there. And the best place to kind of keep up with the Kickstarter campaign, we're just starting to roll out what all the rewards are going to be. Like, you can get your name in the credits of the next two movies. If you want to be a producer on the movies, you can do that. So there's a lot of options. But the Facebook event page for the Kickstarter is out there as well. I think if you look up Kickstart Small Town Monsters 2017, you'll find it.
Excellent. Seth Breedlove, thank you for joining us today to talk about Mothman.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed this paranormal podcast dedicated to cryptids. And I hope that you'll go over to iTunes and rate and review us if you listen that way, or wherever you listen. Please do rate and review us. I would certainly appreciate it. Also, we have a new free show. Used to be a Plus Club show, but now I'm putting out each new episode as a free episode. So you can check it out. Jim Harold's Crime Scene. And right now you can find it on iTunes for iPad, iPhone, iTunes, everything iOS. And then also we have it on Google Play for you Android folks out there. And easy way to find it is just go to jimharold.com. Scroll down the page, you'll find Crime Scene, and then there'll be a couple of banners there where you can click on and subscribe, either for you Mac folk, you Apple folk, or your Android folk, whatever floats your boat, as it were. And next week, we're going to have a great show. Now, going from killing Bigfoot, we're going to talk about something much kinder and gentler. Love from Beyond the Grave with Teresa Argy and Kathy Wepper, the Haunted Housewives, and yet another guest that I'm not telling you about yet. But you'll find out when you tune in next week, and I certainly hope you do. We thank you so much. We will talk to you next time, and have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.